Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From Ferguson, Missouri today to get us going, a story of picking up the economic pieces from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is the 25th of November today, Tuesday. Good to have you with us. It is also a day in which the people of Ferguson are still sorting things out. Business and property, cold hard economic assets, were among the casualties last night. Some will suffer only temporary disruptions and will eventually recover. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports from Ferguson, the damage to the city's long-term redevelopment may be harder to fix.
By now, you've probably seen the images of Ferguson. Buildings set on fire, storefronts smashed in. Today, many schools decided to just keep children home until after Thanksgiving. In other areas, neighboring suburbs and St. Louis itself, damage to property and businesses wasn't as severe. The windows were smashed and shopping districts are boarded up and quiet. It's a particularly bad situation if your business depends on people from the outlying suburbs coming into the city to shop or hang out.
It's really kind of heartbreaking to me because I feel like those people aren't going to come now.
Jesse Cerruti is the founder of the St. Louis Rock and Roll Craft Show, an annual marketplace that moves several $100,000 in crafts created by over 100 artists.
A lot of artists, it's their biggest show of the year. They sell more stuff. It's kind of their year is sort of lopsided because this is the event that they sell the most stuff.
Many businesses are remaining closed. Holiday shopping has ground to a halt in some areas, and the overall impact on tourism or the convention industry is yet to be counted. Still, despite the riots and destruction that are playing out in Ferguson, others say the economic trajectory of St. Louis remains strong. Alex Enan is the owner and editor of NextSTL.com, a regional development blog and website.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of big things kind of on the boards right now. It's IKEA. It's $1 billion in school and medical facility development. And so those things won't stop. Of course, we have to see what happens next and see if that next level of investment happens.
With most development projects clustered around downtown St. Louis, Enan says the next challenge will be to extend that investment into poor areas of St. Louis and its suburbs. But for many Black residents, the idea of a shared economic future seems unimaginable.
When I came outside this morning, it felt real quiet. It ain't never felt that quiet out there like that. Never.
Harold Jones runs Cherokee Cuts, a barbershop in South St. Louis. About a mile away from his shop, police used tear gas to break up an angry demonstration. He says he understands the sense of frustration Blacks feel.
All this old money that St. Louis has in this town, man, and you mean to tell me y'all can't create no jobs for Black people? Yeah, we got to struggle to take care of our kids, our families.
Jones says he plans to keep the barbershop open for the time being, but he says in times like these, it's hard to stay positive when so many of his customers feel such an overwhelming sense of sadness and helplessness. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, both literally and figuratively, a long, long way from Ferguson, Missouri today. Traders were of mixed minds. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here with a question that is going to sound random, but is actually spot on the government regulatory news of the day. How many calories do you figure there are in a slice of pizza? Ignorance is, of course, bliss, unless you happen to be the Food and Drug Administration. They are out with new rules today on businesses having to post calorie counts. It'll affect anything from chain restaurants and vending machines to prepared foods at grocery stores. Some places, like Starbucks and many institutions in the city of New York, are doing this already. But for everybody else, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson asks how one actually counts a calorie under these rules and how accurate, therefore, are those labels.
You know how when you go into a convenience store, there are those hot dogs spinning on a grill or an egg salad sandwich in a cold case? Well, those are some of the many items that now need calorie counts. Lau Beckwith is with the National Association of Convenience Stores, and he's not really sure how to do this yet.
We've not been in this business before. I'm assuming that there are labs that will have to send various products out for testing. The cost and time to be determined.
There are, in fact, labs that do this work. James McKnight works for one of them, QC Laboratories in Pennsylvania.
All they have to do is pretty much send us a sample you know, via UPS, FedEx, give us a serving size, and off we go.
The FDA estimates it'll cost the restaurant industry nearly $85 million over 20 years. QC Labs charges $700 per sample for full nutritional information, about $150 to $200 if they're just using a database of ingredients. Jim Painter is a professor at Eastern Illinois University. He says most of the time, companies are just using databases. So for that slice of pizza Kai mentioned?
Flour, you'd have a little bit of sugar, you'd have the salt, tomato sauce, you'd have whatever ingredients you put on the top. And you would add up all those, you would divide it by what a portion would be, and then that is the calories for that slice of pizza.
Pretty easy, unless the items change a lot or involve a lot of customization, but not perfectly accurate.
It's all pretty much an average, and so it's not a completely accurate number, but at least it gives you a comparison when you're looking at one food compared to another.
So you can compare that slice to the hot dog, to the egg salad, or maybe opt for an apple instead. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
It's been said that you can learn a whole lot by taking a long, hard look in the mirror. But what can a mirror learn about you? Well, quite a bit, it turns out. A fashion boutique has created an interactive dressing room with a mirror that can keep track of who you are and what you try on. Sam Harnett reports it's one of the many ways that retailers are gathering data on what we do once we are inside their stores.
I'm standing in front of the dressing room mirror in fashion designer Rebecca Minkoff's new boutique. It's processing a lot more than just my reflection.
The mirror comes alive. It automatically senses exactly what you brought in by size and color.
Healy Cipher is the head of retail innovation at eBay, which developed the mirror. It's a touchscreen computer that can send you text messages, summon a salesperson, and keep track of what you try on. Cipher says it's gathering all kinds of data that retailers have never been able to capture inside a store.
Where online is a very binary kind of black and white, the physical world is all the beautiful shades of gray that are truly useful information.
It gets even more beautiful for retailers if they can connect what customers look at online with what they buy and try on in a store, which is what happens if you download and use the Rebecca Minkoff app. CEO Uri Minkoff says the rich profile it develops helps sales reps sell you stuff in the store.
And I know that you love the color black, you love the color pink, you're a size 7 shoe, right? Let me help you now.
Other retailers, like Macy's and American Eagle, are tracking your smartphone as you move through their stores, so they can see where you go and what you look at. MIT professor Sanan Aral says touchscreens and apps are currently expensive, but he expects the cost to go down and more stores to go digital.
In the near future, they're going to get quite smart quite fast.
For now, it's likely the only thing a dressing room mirror knows about you is what you look like. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
There are plus or minus 300 million smokers in China. That is just about the same number of people who live in this country, the entire United States of America. Smoking also kills about 1 million Chinese a year. So now comes word from Beijing that China is considering, we should stress, banning smoking in public places and getting rid of tobacco advertising. On the face of it, it's an effort by the government to control healthcare costs. But there is actually a whole lot more going on here. So we've called Matthew Korman. He's a professor of anthropology at Stanford who studies smoking in China. Matthew, good to have you with us.
Hi there, Kai.
Let me ask you the anthropological question and not the business question, right? For those who might not have been to China, help us understand how pervasive smoking is over there. Where are some of the places we'd be surprised to see people smoking?
Oh, you would be finding people smoking in lots of different contexts that you might not expect. Hospitals are still places where you see a lot of cigarette smoking, hallways, stairwells, restrooms. That's been cut back a little bit, but it's still pretty prominent. In taxi cabs, it's very common. In schools, you'll see cigarette smoking on campuses, not by the kids, but you'll still see it among instructors and people walking through campus.
What about airplanes?
So airplanes are really intriguing. For years now, I've been flying on Chinese airplanes. And shortly after the flight takes off, I've almost on every flight smelled cigarette smoke. And for years, I always figured, well, someone in the back who's got a fierce nicotine habit has been having a couple of quick tugs on a cigarette. But what I've come to understand is actually people are pretty responsive to the signage and the messaging they get from the flight attendants, all except for those who are flying the plane. So what you have is the plane takes off shortly after it reaches cruising speed. The pilots and all the co-pilots, one or more of them light up, and because of the way things circulate on a plane, you smell it in the back very quickly.
And of course, there are no smoke detectors probably in the cockpit, right?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
But I've never been invited up.
Well, that's right. What do you suppose the effect of this proposed limitation, we should say, I mean, it's not written in stone yet, but what's going to happen over there if this actually eventually becomes policy and law? Is it going to change the way people smoke?
I think it will, and it's going to be part of an incremental shift that's been going on for some years now.
Right.
Two or three years ago, there was some new regulations that came down that said smoking was to be banned in all restaurants, and it had almost no effect. Even in Beijing, I would go to restaurants with people who were working for the WHO, and people would be smoking all around us. Mm.
I said I wouldn't ask you the finance, business, and economy question, but I will. The biggest tobacco company in the world is the Chinese National Tobacco Company, right?
So that's right. And if I can jump in, I would say
please.
To my mind, this is a sideshow, and it's a sideshow that's part and parcel of the way tobacco control is taken up, not just in China, but in much of the world. And it's the way it's taken up by the World Health Organization. It's about trying to shift consumer behavior. It really ignores production. It ignores supply. And most people would think that cigarette production has gone down worldwide over the last two or three decades, right?
Yeah.
In fact, it hasn't.
Yeah.
Cigarette production has tripled since the 1960s. China has become the world's cigarette superpower. Local governments have become increasingly dependent on cigarette sales to bolster their tax revenues. So all of this question of whether or not these new regulations will be enforced will, in the end, come down to local politics.
Right.
And that's where the rubber is going to meet the road.
Matthew Korman is a professor of anthropology at Stanford University. He concentrates, as you might have gathered, on things happening over in China. Matthew, thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
Coming up,
your neighborhood is gentrifying when boutique grocery stores start popping up left and right.
Think about it. How do you know? We're going to kick off a series on gentrification straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, not a whole lot today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrial is basically flat, down 2 points, 17,814. The S&P 500 also gave back 2 points, a 10%, 2,067. The NASDAQ picked up 3 points, less than a 10%, finished at 4,758. Revised GDP numbers out this morning showed the economy grew faster than expected in the third quarter, but consumer confidence moved down. Financial firms took the glass half empty approach. JPMorgan Chase withdrew 1%. Morgan Stanley shaved off 0.9% today. With the Thanksgiving travel crush on the way, airline stocks were betting that our pain will be their gain. United lifted 0.6% today. Delta climbed 1.3%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department is busy issuing a number of reports for October: personal income and spending, durable goods orders, and sales of new homes. This is for the birds. President Obama pardons the Thanksgiving turkey. And a nationwide productivity vacuum is expected as workers cut the day short to get the long holiday weekend started a little early and beat the traffic. Good luck. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Boy, there is nothing like a good lame duck session at Congress to concentrate the mind, huh? Never has the phrase, so much to do, so little time, been more accurate. One thing, however, that will surely slip to the new Congress that will gather in January will be advising and consenting, or perhaps not consenting, I suppose, to the nomination of Loretta Lynch as the new Attorney General of the United States. When debate starts, the Senate will parse Lynch's record as a federal prosecutor in New York, as well as her time in private practice. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports now on what that record might say about how Lynch would handle Wall Street and consumers.
In announcing Loretta Lynch's nomination, President Obama said the U.S. Attorney General oversees cases that impact on the lives of every American. Then Lynch stepped to the podium.
The Department of Justice is the only cabinet department named for an ideal. And this is actually appropriate because our work is both aspirational and grounded in gritty reality.
Behind that ideal is a lot of power. John Coffey teaches law at Columbia University. He says the attorney general has wide latitude in setting priorities and will decide the scope of financial fraud investigations.
Decisions about how you allocate your troops, what you prioritize. You can set up special task force at the Department of Justice level.
Lynch has served twice as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, which includes some of New York City. She's prosecuted cases against mobsters and corrupt politicians, but Lynch also worked as a white-collar criminal defense lawyer at the firm Hogan & Hartson, which is now known as Hogan Lovells. Dennis Tracy is managing partner of their New York office and worked with Lynch for about 6 years.
Loretta is low-key, but if she believes in something, she will push it until she reaches the conclusion that she wants.
Of course, we don't know what conclusion she'd want as attorney general. Her office declined our request for an interview. Current Attorney General Eric Holder has faced criticism for punishing banks, but not the individuals running them. So how tough would Lynch be on banks, considering her time at Hogan Lovells? Again, her former coworker, Dennis Tracy.
She was a white-collar defense lawyer, but she spent just as many or more years as a prosecutor.
Lynch is part of a Justice Department task force on Wall Street's role in the financial crisis, along with New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman. He thinks Lynch would be tough.
There have only been settlements with three banks. The work of the task force is not done. She's independent, and she's willing to follow an investigation wherever it leads, regardless of the politics.
But of course, politics is involved. Democrats want the Senate to vote on Lynch's nomination this year before Republicans take control. Schneiderman doesn't think she'll have any trouble. After all, he says, the Senate already confirmed her as a U.S. attorney twice. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a whole category of business that we talk about every now and then that basically consists of providing services to other businesses. In the software and high-tech world, it's come to be known as enterprise solutions. And now, as social media matures, it too is getting into the enterprise game. Nova Sappho reports.
When employees come to work, they often bring their mobile devices and social networking habits with them.
Workforces have become much more virtualized.
That's David Seamer. He's a venture capitalist who has investments in enterprise technologies. Seamer says with changing workforces comes changing business needs.
Having just a kind of a network drive and whatnot, you know, used to be considered kind of collaboration, and now we need a lot better tools.
With a lack of such tools, a lot of employees have been using consumer-oriented networks, like texting apps and cloud-based shared drives. And that has its security pitfalls, says Cabrina Chang, who researches business law and ethics at Boston University.
People posting on Facebook, my boss is at a meeting in Switzerland, you know, doesn't seem very meaningful. But to competitors, that actually might be an indication of something cooking.
There are hundreds of companies, from internet giants to startups, now seeing an opportunity to create more secure networks. Trevor Hellebuck is with the firm Metalogix, which helps companies with Microsoft cloud computing.
Part of this is a big land grab where these vendors are really struggling with each other to sort of capture your content.
And while there are lots of players, Hellebuck says the numbers do shrink when considering which companies have multiple tools in one platform.
Enterprise social, file sync and share, team-based collab. There's really only a couple players that have that out there, and it's Microsoft, it's Google, it's potentially IBM.
And IBM added to that mix this past summer. It signed an enterprise deal with one of the biggest players of them all, Apple. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Whether you're a briner or a deep fryer or a straight-up baster-and-stick-it-in-the-oven type, you do know there are alternatives to turkey, yes? Might I humbly suggest, tradition be damned, tofu. The tofurkey, to be precise. It's been a reliable vegetarian and vegan go-to at Thanksgiving gatherings for 20 years now, all thanks to a guy by the name of Seth Tibbett. He happens to be the founder and president of the Tofurkey Company. Mr. Tibbett, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
For the uninitiated among us, maybe we ought to have you describe exactly what tofurkey is first, huh?
Sure. Tofurkey is the original and number one selling meat alternative of turkey in America. And this is its 20th anniversary this year. We first sold 500 tofurkeys in Portland, Oregon in 1995.
How did it come to pass? I mean, were you walking down the street one day as a longtime vegetarian and said, man, you know what we need is a turkey made out of tofu?
Well, I was a vegetarian since 1972, and there was a whole lot of miserable Thanksgivings where I just didn't have anything great to eat. You know, I ate a lot of side dishes or complicated recipes that I worked on all day that never turned out, like a gluten roast that I couldn't cut with a chainsaw.
Ooh, ah.
And so I was always looking for a substitute for turkey. And I had been in business since 1980 as a small little soy processor making tempeh. And in 1995, I teamed up with a friend of mine who was making a tofu roast in Portland, and we named it Tofurkey. And as I say, the rest is history.
Talk to me for a second about how you started your company up. You bootstrapped it, right?
Yes. I started the Tofurkey company on $2,500, and we grew kind of the Kaizen incremental growth method. We never sold equity to any outside investors or venture capitalists. I wish I had had Kickstarter around when I started it. The one person I did sell a little bit of company to was in 1990. I sold my brother 27% of the Tofurkey company for $17,000.
Without asking you to divulge trade secrets, which by this point are extremely valuable for you, how do you conquer the texture problem, right? Because I like tofu as much as the next guy, but it's not turkey, man, I'm telling you.
Well, that's a great question, because in meat alternatives, it's the texture that's often the stumbling block that takes longer to develop than the flavor does, because flavor companies now are really getting so much better at producing just about any knockoff of meat flavor that you can imagine. And so we texture it with vital wheat gluten and some bean flours, garbanzo bean, white bean flours, and that's... We have special machines. They're all meat processing equipment that we've adapted to our tofurkey needs.
Is tofurkey your biggest product? I imagine holidays, or this holiday specifically, is huge for you.
Well, the holiday is about 17% of our sales right now. Huh. And more of our sales come from actually our deli slices and our sausage and other tofurkey products, which make up about 85% of our overall revenues.
If I, as a carnivore, tasted a tofurkey in a blind taste test, would I be able to tell the difference between that and the real thing?
You probably would, but I think you would find tofurkey to be very savory and very turkey-esque and sort of white meat more than dark meat.
Seth Tibbett is the president and founder of the Tofurkey Company out of Hood River, Oregon. Mr. Tibbett, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Happy Tofurkey Day.
And to you. We're going to be doing a special series on the program next week, the end result of a four-month project that our Wealth and Poverty team has been doing here in Los Angeles. It's about a rapidly changing community called Highland Park. Gentrification is the buzzword you'll recognize, the ways in which Highland Park is being transformed by money, by new people moving in, and by upscale businesses setting up shop. Gentrification can, of course, be seen in cities all over the country, so we've been asking people all over the country what it looks like to them. We went to Durham, North Carolina first and asked people to finish this sentence. You know your neighborhood is gentrifying when?
You know your neighborhood is gentrifying when you see a heavy population in downtown after 5 o'clock.
I feel I know my neighborhood is gentrifying when I have two or more white people buy homes in my neighborhood. I get a little leery that in a couple of years, everything is going to get to be too expensive to continue to live there.
I know my neighborhood is gentrifying when people that hadn't cut their grass before and tried to spruce up the exterior of their homes start to do that and get those cars that were parked there for a while, move them out, and stuff like that.
You know your neighborhood is gentrifying when boutique grocery stores start popping up left and right.
I have seen my neighborhood gentrifying. I mean, the taxes are up and the streets are starting to get better and they're starting to talk about putting in sidewalks and things like that. It's a good thing if you want to sell your house. It's a good thing if you're ready to move. But if you've been in your house for quite a while, if you're used to the neighborhood, no, it's not.
From Durham, North Carolina, that was In Order, Lynn Smith, Barbara Logan, Barbara Hill, Pat Hecker, and Eugene Lofton. So the same question to you then. You know your neighborhood is gentrifying when what? Hit us up on Twitter. We're at Marketplace. Use our hashtag, GentrificationIs.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which higher education takes on a whole new meaning, there is word from JetBlue and Coursera, which is one of the companies developing MOOCs. That's massive open online courses. Anyway, they're saying that passengers will be able to watch educational videos during those long hours on flights where, come on, be honest, it's tough to get anything done anyway. Content will come from Wharton, the University of Edinburgh, and the Berklee School of Music, among others. Or you could just enjoy the time alone and read a good book. But, you know, maybe that's just me. All right, we're out of here. The Dow basically flat today, down 2 points. The Nasdaq up 3 points, less than a 10%. The S&P 500 down that same 2 points, a 10%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.